Right before we start, just a quick announcement. As you may have seen in the email, I don't know if you read it carefully, this Please God will be the last of the series on the Rav. And next Monday night, we're going to be starting back to our original series from 2008, Great Rabbinic Thinkers. And we're going to be going back to the Würzburger Rav Seligman Bear Bamberger, who was really the leading post-egg in Germany for much of the 19th century. And so that will be starting next week. We will send out a registration email. You will require a new registration for, you know, the new series. So just to let you know. So we'll Achron Achman Chaviv. So thank you for this series and for all the series. And we look forward to learning with you and good times for many, many years. Okay, Vakasha, Dr. Mark.
Okay, and I'll just say that if you haven't heard of him, very interesting. It's worth returning. And we will also devote a couple of classes there to the great dispute between him and Hirsch about separatism, Austrit or not, which begins then, but takes us all to the present day. So we have a lot to do. Also, I will tell you, for those who've been waiting, my new post just appeared on the Sforim blog, and you'll get the great pictures of Rabbi Yochai Yaakov Weinberg. Really unbelievable, the first color pictures ever. And I, like I said before, I know people are going to forget it's me. And I bet you in a week or so, someone's going to email me something. Did I see these great pictures of Rabbi Weinberg that's going around? It's not the first time that things like that have happened. But at least the people listening to the Sforim blog know that it's that I found them, and it's my continuing quest to find more material about him. And I have more pictures of his that are coming out. Because I want to finish today, I thought we might have two or three more classes, but in preparing, I see today will be the last day. I'm going to save the correspondence, the emails that people have sent me until the end of class, and I'll get to that at the end. And if I can't finish it today, we can always do it next week. But this I can't resist. I just have to say, because we have Toronto people here, no one mentioned this. Rather, one of the listeners mentioned the Shomrei Shabbos Shul, or Shomrei Shabbos, I think it's called, in Toronto, Rabbi Felder Shul. The great Aryeh Felder and his son Shul, to this day, they do not duchen on Shabbos. So another people emailed me about that as well, and I'll get to that later. Okay, I just want to pick up now in the book on page, there's only a few more letters to go through. Page 293, the Roth has a long letter. It's 10 pages, almost 9 pages on the commandment to redeem the firstborn. I think this is noteworthy because it's addressed to a Catholic priest. As Helfgott says in his introduction, while the Rav vigorously rejected any interfaith dialogue on religious matters, he was not averse to explain the Jewish point of view on various topics for those who requested insights. So Catholic priest wrote to the Rav, and Rabbi Soloveitchik he was from Boston, so he knew who the Rav was. And it's undated, so we don't know. Priest worked at this thing called the Catholic Information Center until 1958. So the Rav's letter was before that. But the Rav takes the time, not with a one or two paragraph letter, a long letter, which he never expected to be published, in which he explains the whole idea, new concepts on redeeming the firstborn. So that says something about the Rav. So I just want to note that without getting into the nitty gritty. If my audio is breaking up, maybe it's your computer, maybe your wireless, I don't know. I'm actually wired. I'm connected because I know that makes it the best. Although when I was looking for a new computer earlier this year, I was only able to get one PC, find one PC that actually still has a plug. Everything else is wireless, and you can connect it by a mechanism that is wireless, and then you connect to it, but it's not completely wired. So fortunately, I am, but right now, but I know if I wasn't, I think I might be having problems. On page 307, the Rav has a letter here published from 1960, which was sent to the Tug Morgan Journal, the Yiddish paper, an Orthodox Yiddish paper. And the Rav wrote about the value of the Yiddish language. this is a significant letter, I think, because you get a sense of the world's feelings about non, I guess, not a Torah matter, but a matter that's very important to Judaism, Jewish culture, Jewish tradition. He says that he says he's not a Yiddishist, but he does think that Yiddish has an absolute value. Now, you know, the Rav gave Yortzeit Shir in Yiddish. He gave Shir in Yiddish. He stopped giving Shir in Yiddish when one of the students, after the first day in Shir, said they didn't understand it. So the Rav announced the next day it's going to be in English. And that's how it was. And I know someone who was in the Shir at the time, and he says the Rav's English was more complicated than his Yiddish, harder for us to understand. Now, just as a side point, this student that is the reason for the Rav going to English. Granted, he would have gone to English eventually. Unfortunately, this student didn't turn out so well for him, and I don't think we want to give him the august title of student of the Rav because of how his life turned out. I don't need to go into details, but he was a rabbi in New Haven. So if you know the story, fine. If you don't know the story, you can look it up. He's doing time, a long time, for his unfortunate criminal misdeeds. So he says that I'm not a Yiddishist. He doesn't believe that Yiddish has an absolute value, but he says I'm a Gemoriid. And this is an important point he makes, that holiness and absoluteness are not always identical. He says that there's two ideas of holiness. There's gufei kedusha, something that's intrinsically holy, and tashmishei kedusha, objects of holiness. And he gives an example. If there's a fire on Shabbos, and let's just assume theoretically it's in an area where you don't have to be concerned that the fire is going to spread, or anything like that. So we don't say you just put out the fire in any way you want to. But it says that halacha has ruled that in such a case when there's a fire, not only do you rescue the Torah scroll, but the cover in which it is wrapped must be rescued. Not only the tefillin is rescued, but also the tefillin bag. Why? Because they're tashmishei kedusha. They don't have inherent holiness, but they wrap the item that has holiness. You know, the Rav makes a similar comment about the Israeli flag. Obviously, the Israeli flag doesn't have Kedusha, but it has a semi-Kedusha, like Tashmishei Kedusha. We know that martyrs, if someone is killed, Kiddush Hashem, we bury the person together with his garment, his blood-soaked garment. And the Rav says that the Israeli flag, you know how many Jews have been killed defending this flag? That this flag, what it stands for, and therefore the flag. Here's an example where the Rav is like very Zionistic, waxing eloquent, I can even say, that the flag is you know, Ramosha Feinstein, when he's asked about having a flag in a show, his attitude is like a flag, it's a flag from the heretics. But if you want to have it, you know, you can have it in the show. The Rav sees this as akin to holiness because it's this flag that is connected to so many people who've died al Kiddush Hashem. So we see the same thing here, that the idea that you have holiness inherent, and then you have Tashmishei Kedusha, things are related to this. By the way, in the latest post, I quote the Rav, who agrees with Meir Simcha. The Rav really doesn't agree with holiness as something inherent. He sees it as a... hold on, let me read it here. He sees holiness not as inherent, but something that's it's born out of, he says, man's actions and experiences. That is, the land of Israel is not inherently holy. If there's no people living there fulfilling mitzvos, it wouldn't have the holiness, or if it didn't have the ability to allow us to perform mitzvos. It's the Remeir Simcha says the same thing. We don't need to go get into it. But so the Rav, though, is speaking, obviously, tefillin, because of what we do with tefillin and the Sefer Torah. So he says that Yiddish has no intrinsic holiness, but he says it's in the category of Tashmishei Kedusha, which have to be defended at all costs. After all, he says, is there any more beautiful container, you know, in which Torah has been wrapped in, as it were, than Yiddish? Who spoke Yiddish, he says? The Rav Ma, the Marsha, the Gaon of Vilna. Every single great Torah scholar in Europe for hundreds of years spoke Yiddish, taught Torah in Yiddish, thought in Yiddish. As such, Yiddish is valuable, and Yiddish needs to be preserved. He says it's the language of the Baal Shem Tov, the Mezud Shematik, the Alter Rebbe. That's the language they revealed Maisa Bereishis in. It's Rechaim of Elojin and all, etc. This is how the Jewish masses express their faith in Yiddish. To this day, he says, the eminent Rosh Yeshiva deliver their shirim in Yiddish. Such a container is certainly holy. And it's a great merit to defend this. Okay, well, then how far do you go in defending it? You know, this is in 1960. By 1970, it was a completely different story, even for the Rav. I don't know what that means for us today. I'm fortunate that I can understand much of the Rav's Yiddish and other Yiddish, but that's because of German. I wasn't zocha to be brought up speaking Yiddish. Some of you were, and you went to yeshiva. I mean, it's sort of like you can't put the genie back in the bottle. What are you going to do? You're going to start, yes, if people want to take Yiddish in college, it's a nice thing. But for our communities, it's become of, I guess, it's entered the realm of the arcane or of antiquarian interest. It's not something that, unless you're, you know, becoming a scholar in Jewish history, that you want to read the Yiddish papers. You know, it's something that we have to put to the side. Although, well, the Hasidim, not the Litvish, but the Hasidim, I think it's amazing. You go into Kiryas Yoel, you go into, and it's not all the Hasidim. It's only some of the Hasidim, but you still see the little kids speaking the Mamo Lashon, and it's great that someone is carrying it on. You can go to the Catskills. They have this farm up there for secular Yiddishists, and you have a number of secular people. There's been a revival of Yiddish. You have the Yiddish Book Center in Massachusetts. You have YIVO, and there has been a revival of Yiddish, but what's a revival of Yiddish? You have a few people, you know, studying it, and you have some Yiddish festivals, but it's never going to be a language of the masses anymore, and that's just the way it is. And we can't create a Volksschule or anything, but it would be nice. It would be very nice if our schools, our high schools even, would teach Yiddish as an option. Unfortunately, not only don't teach Yiddish as an option, even languages is tough to get to. We have day schools in America, high schools, where they don't teach any languages anymore at all. Instead, they teach coding. That's the language. And I know that in other schools, they have an option. You could take a Spanish or coding. And that's it. And that's Yiddish, forget it. Who's going to sign up for it? When I was in high school, he asked the principal, could he offer a course in Latin? I thought, you know, why not take Latin? I don't think there's one Jewish, I shouldn't say that, maybe Ramaz, but I don't know of any Jewish high schools that teach Latin. But the principal, to his credit, said to me, if you can get enough people to take the course, I'll offer it. He said, I'll get, and it's actually, if you know Latin, there's a lot of jobs you can get. It's a seller's market because there aren't that many people left to teach it, and there still are schools that want it. But needless to say, at my high school, other than yours truly, there wasn't anyone else interested in Latin, so it wasn't going to happen. But Yiddish, Tashmishei Kedusha. Okay, on the next, I'll skip the next couple letters. One is to Pinchas Pelli. Pinchas Pelli published one of the most important writings of the Rav before, you know, the explosion of writings of the Rav, namely On Repentance, Ahalat Shuvah. If you've never read it, I recommend checking it out. A couple of years ago in Shul on Yom Kippur, I guess he was bored, I don't know, but there was a guy reading Ahalat Shuvah. Right? I guess it's out of all the things you're going to read, that's the best thing to read. But you can read it before 1 year before the Yomim Noraim, I read it. And it's really great stuff. And so we have to give credit to Pinchas Pelli, who was quite close to the Rav. He's actually the uncle of Dr. Aviad HaKohen, who's written a good deal about the Rav, the dean of the academic college in, was it the law school? I forget which one. It's in, maybe David can remember to help us. But Aviad HaKohen, whose father is Rabbi Mordechai HaKohen, the longtime Knesset member from the Labor Party. Following that, he has a letter on blowing the shofar and the silent Amidah to Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld. We can skip that. Incidentally, with regard to Rabbi Fabian Schoenfeld, in Rakefet's book on Rabbi Eliezer Silver, he mentions that Fabian Schoenfeld, you know, he's from England, he's a brother-in-law of Emanuel Jacobovitz, but at one of the Aguda conventions, Fabian Schoenfeld attended, I think it was an Aguda convention, and someone made a negative comment about Fabian, use a Goyish name, and Rabbi Eliezer Silver replied that, you know, there's even a Tosafist named Peter. And we discussed this in the past. One of the Balaitosas has named Peter. So if you can be named Peter, you can be named Fabian. But I think his Hebrew name is Shragafival, as I recall. But very, very close student to the Rav. After this, there's a letter to Shaul Lieberman, the one we know a good deal about. 18 classes we had on Shaul Lieberman. So he doesn't measure up to the Rav. This is our 21st class. But we spent a good deal about Shaul Lieberman. And take a look at my post today. Something from Rav Shaul Lieberman I included, and I have new, more stuff in the next post on Rav Shaul Lieberman. This is just about a Torah matter they discussed. I mean, the Rav begins by saying, he calls him my relative, my friend and relative. He says that, you know, we were, what does he say? First of all, he thanks him for the Tosefta Kipshuta, but he says, regarding our conversation that evening under the heavens, I want to deal with what we spoke about. That's what people like the Rav and Lieberman, when they get together, immediately they start talking and learning. You know, I forgot to mention in the previous class, we're speaking about Rav Volk, who also was a bit of an adversary of the Rav, and I told you about this memoir that the man described Rav Volk from the Tel's Yeshiva. I forgot to mention that he also says he came to New York once. This is a South African, from Litza, from Tel's, who went to South Africa, the rabbi, and then went to, what's his name? I forget his name, Bloomfield? Whatever his name was. So he describes how he comes to New York and he calls up his old friend Rav Volk on the phone, and Rav Volk says to him, come visit me so we can learn together. I mean, that's what Rav Volk wanted to do. The next letter is a short letter, which is by Dr. Mirsky of YU, a great scholar. And then there's two letters dealing with the Book of Echa to his mechutin, Dr. Yechiel Lichtenstein, or Lichtenstein. I'm not sure how they pronounce it. Everyone calls him Varon Lichtenstein. I don't know if really they're supposed to pronounce it Lichtenstein, but this is the Rav's Mechutin, and he wrote a book on Echa. There's been a lot of books on Echa recently coming out, both Erica Brown and Joshua Berman had a book on Echa, and I think there's another one on Echa. I've never seen Dr. Yechiel Lichtenstein's book on Echa. So you have the Rav's interpretations there. And finally, I just want to pick up with letters, the third to last letter on page 331. It's a letter to the Dean of Stern College, Dr. Dan Vogel, from 1961. And the Rav was asked, the Rav gave a lecture at the National Institute of Mental Health on suffering. And this lecture appears in the book Out of the Whirlwind. So the Rav says as follows. I just want to cite this. And the Rav says this idea in numerous other places. However, here he says it, in an abridged form. He speaks about Job, the book of Job. I mean, you all remember the story of the book of Job? Who was it I just heard saying that the Book of Job is his favorite book? I think Erica Brown, I heard a podcast, it's not an Echa, it's Ecclesiastes, Kohelis, that's what she wrote about. I'll take that back. And then Berman wrote about Kohelis also. But I think it was Robert Alter maybe said Eov, I'm not sure. But basically the story is, for those who don't know it, Eov is living a good... He comes from the land of Uz. I mean, obviously, it's not an actual story of an actual person. Already the Gemara gives us as an option, but I think that's, without a doubt, that's the pshat. Just look at the names and the whole story. It's all contrived to create this important, valuable lesson, a lesson that people in our community should know also. It's not just the evangelicals who mess this whole thing up. So what am I talking about? Well, Eov has everything, all the good life. And then the Satan says, well... you know, Eov is such a good person. He says it to God because everything is good with him. Make it a little difficult to them, and then see what happens. He'll curse you. He'll curse. He'll reject it all. So God sends all sorts of trials and tribulations. He loses his money, his family, and at first Job accepts it, but then his friends say to him, "Well, you know, Eov, you must have sinned. That's why these things happen to you." I mean, that's a common answer, right? The theodicy. Why bad things happen. to good people. Often they give an answer because you sinned. And Job, though, he knows that can't be true. He hasn't done such bad things that he'd be that he'd get this. It's like, think of the Holocaust. Think of what just happened in Israel. And then you have a whole long book. And then at the end of the book, God appears out of the whirlwind and he speaks to Eov. And he says to Eov that, where were you when I created the world? When I did it, basically he's saying that you're a little cog in the wheel. You're nothing. You're a tiny little speck out of this whole universe. How do you expect to understand, you know, these matters? These matters are beyond you. And, it's not saying there is no reason for these things happening, but we can't understand the reason. And then God turns to the friends of Eov and says, you have spoken falsely. That is, it could be that this is how I understand it. It could be that bad things happened to me because I sinned. And maybe I could say that about myself. But the idea that you know that you can say that bad things are happening to someone over there because of what they did, God says directly to these people, Eliphaz and the rest of them, that you spoke falsely, because humans can never know for certainty why such a thing happened. There are reasons, but we can't understand it. We know about all these evangelicals who can tell you why hurricanes and bad things happened. Well, it must be because of the gays or this and that. But we've had in our own community rabbis who can tell you why this happened, why that happened. It's sneos problems. It's a Shabbos violation. Only thing I can say to be Muhammad Schuss is that they think they're speaking to a community that is so simple and unsophisticated that if they hear this message, maybe they'll have more tznius and observe Shabbos better. But I do not believe they can really accept this as what they don't think they're prophets, these rabbis, and they certainly know the lesson of the book of Eov. So what is, with this background, what does the Rav say? He says that in dealing with suffering, Judaism, what does Judaism say? That the metaphysical inquiry, namely, why did bad things happen? Theodicy should be replaced by the halachic ethical gesture. Don't ask, the Rav says, why is there evil? Don't ask, why are these bad things happening? Rather, you should raise the question, what am I supposed to do if confronted with evil? That's the lesson of the book of Job. Job isn't given an answer. He doesn't understand why the bad thing happened. But now he has faith in God that whatever happened, it happened for a reason. So he doesn't have an answer, but he no longer has a question, because it's not for us to understand these matters. Now, of course, easier said than done. And maybe this falls into Yitz Greenberg's comment that don't try to explain evil unless you'd feel comfortable saying it sitting next to a parent whose child is dying of leukemia. But nevertheless, that is the lesson of the book of Eov, that there's things that we can simply not understand. And I don't think that falls into the Greenberg trap, because at the end of the day, we have no explanations. And the honest person at a funeral, when faced with a tragedy, will acknowledge that. The rabbi will acknowledge, we don't understand. We can't understand everything in this world. And that's the lesson of Eov. And we have to deal with the evil and the suffering and see what to do with it. And the Rav repeats this again and again. And he's very actually contemptuous of attempts to explain. He doesn't, not just because it's unsophisticated and it's assuming the role of prophet to explain evil, but he thinks it really undermines a basic Jewish value in that God wants us to deal with suffering in the unquestioning way that Eov in the end comes to terms with it, that these are things beyond our ken. But this doesn't mean we give anything up. No, this is part of life, and we go forward. It's the duty of man to meet the challenge, namely the challenge of evil, boldly and courageously. Suffering is not to be purposeless. Rather, out of it emerges the ethical norm, the call for repentance, for self-elevation. So that's what evil and suffering is about, how we are going to respond to it, what we are going to do about it. We're not God. and we can't understand everything in this world. And as far as the Rav is concerned, we're not supposed to try to understand it because that's not our role. And he says, and I think this has a lot of relevance in Yonah Deyoma for what's going on in Israel right now, man was summoned to defy evil and try to eliminate it. That's our job. The Rav says he doesn't want us to philosophize about the nature of evil within a framework of theodicy. Rather, our job is to fight it relentlessly and to convert it to a constructive force. So powerful words from the Rav, and he elaborates on this in greater detail in other places. The second to last letter, is a letter to the great Yiddish author Chaim Grada. I've spoken of Grada on numerous occasions. Grada, who starts out as a student of the Chazon Ish in Vilna. And when I say a student, the Chazon Ish was not a Rebbe. He didn't have lots of students. He had like one student in Vilna, you know, Chaim Grada. When he came to Israel, he had other students. You can count them on two hands, the students. One with Tzvi Yehuda, who spoke for Torah in Motion once. If you go on YouTube, you can find I gave a talk, me and Benny Brown gave a talk. They honored Tzvi Yehuda. And I spoke about the letters because some of the important letters, in fact, I think the most important letters in the collected letters of the Chazon Ish are addressed to none other than Tzvi Yehuda, who I wrote on the Sforim blog about. You can see him. But the Chaim Grada, he then has a break. He breaks with the Chazon Ish and this lifestyle. He becomes a secular Yiddish writer. But he still loved the Chazon Ish. There's a letter in the letters of the Chazon Ish to Chaim Grada, actually, after he became irreligious. Chaim Grada couldn't go to Israel as long as the Chazon Ish was alive because he couldn't face him. Knowing what he became, he was happy to be a secularist and wanted, after the Chazon Ish dies, he goes to Israel and he goes to the Gur Cemetery and he writes a poem, which has been translated to Hebrew, I don't know, maybe English as well, about who the Chazon Ish was. And in the Haredi world, they love this poem. Even though they usually don't like non-religious, the Chaim Grada, they think that he's something special. Also, of course, Tzemach Atlas, the yeshiva, his description of the Chazon Ish there is, in the Haredi world, they love that also, because they say he has the best description of the Chazon Ish. In general, it's an amazing work, talking about the Musar movement and everything. Lieberman loved Chaim Grada. He said that Chaim Grada should have won the Nobel Prize, not Isaac Bashevis Singer. People like Lieberman thought Isaac Bashevis Singer were basically semi-pornographers creating scandal in their writing, but Chaim Grada really gave us a vision of a world. And after World War II, it was a lost world. I know I heard this from Alan Nadler, who was he knew Chaim Grada quite well. In fact, he brought Chaim Grada to speak at Harvard. I posted once the video of Chaim Grada speaking at Harvard. He told me that Chaim Grada was very annoyed because everyone wants to come to speak to Chaim Grada. What do they want to speak about? They all want to speak about the Chazon Ish. No one's coming to speak to Chaim Grada about his writings and everything. They all want to speak about the Chazon Ish. Because the non-religious, most of them don't know Yiddish, or most of them don't know that world. And the Orthodox, they all want to speak about Chazon Ish. I'll also tell you something else he told me. So he picked up Chaim Grada. Tversky invited Chaim Grada to come to Harvard. He gave two talks, I think, on Yiddish literature. So on the way, Nadler drove him to, was driving him there. Grada said he was hungry. So he said, where to eat? So Grada said, pointed to somebody and said, you know, Burger King. So he goes to Burger King and he orders like a hamburger. So he asked Nadler, why don't you get it? So he says, well, it's not kosher. So Grada says, it's glatt kosher. So you see that from a student of the Chazon Ish to be completely irreligious, nevertheless, a great recorder of Jewish culture. And obviously a great representative of what it means to write in Yiddish. So the Rav writes to him here. And he thanked him for sending him one of his books, his book on the Chazon Ish. It's a book of his poetry that includes poems and like elegies, Helfgott tells us about the Chazon Ish. It's not a biography or anything. It's just some of his reflections. But if you want to know about the Chazon Ish, you have to read his book, The Yeshiva. And he says, "I marvel at your creativity in describing Lithuanian Gaon, whose greatness on first impression expresses itself only in intellectual dimensions." And the Rav says, "But you show that he was a multidimensional, towering personality, filled with fervor, passion, and soulfulness." So, you know, the Rav is very impressed with the description of the Chazon Ish. And then in the P.S., he refers to the book Tzemach Atlas, which is Grada's book, translated English as The Yeshiva, in which certain of his descriptions there, he says that you describe how your mother would go home on Yom Kippur afternoon to feed the cat, a moving story. So he said, the Rav was a great connoisseur and consumer, I should say, of Yiddish literature. Everything from Peretz to the whole gamut. The Rav was so broad. And how could you be a lover of Yiddish literature, especially coming from Lithuania, and not know Chaim Grada? I don't know if the Tzemach Atlas, the Yeshiva's in print. I think it's two volumes even. Yeah, it's two volumes. It's definitely worth, if you haven't read it, it's definitely worth, he has another volume translated to English. I think My Mother's Shabbos Candle, something like that. Short stories, but great stuff. And finally, Achron Chaviv, the last letter, number 72. It's been a long time. 21 classes. That takes us 5 weeks, 5 months. It's been great. It's been a real thrill reading all these letters with you, with the Rav, all the things I learned from what you sent me, the comments, the questions, the discussion. So it's a shame to end, but we'll have to end with this letter. And then following, I'm going to get to the comments that people sent me. But the letter deals with the Rav gave a shiur. There used to be a shul called the Maria Shul on the Upper West Side. I don't know when it closed down, in the 80s, I guess. The Rav taught there till from 52 to 1980, Helfgott tells us. It was founded by, well, Nikki, who's, I don't know if she's with us tonight. She's usually with us. Her family were very important in this shul. And I met other people from the shul from Belgium, Antwerp. But the Rav will do the shiur. This is a shiur from Balabatim. So it's not the same sort of shiur that he gave at YU, but he would, I mean, it's a Gemara shiur. He'd speak about the Parsha. Well, American Jewish Congress, of blessed memory, used to have a monthly called Congress Monthly. Before that, it was called Congress Biweekly. And one of the attendees at the Rav Shiur, Morris Laub, he wrote an article on what it was like being at the Rav's shiur, that although it was for Baal Batim, rabbis used to come also, especially if you live in the Upper West Side. And he sent it to the Rav. This is in 1972. And the Rav replied to him, first of all, thanking him for this, that he's very impressed by the emotional warmth and affection which you portrayed the shiurim. I'm very impressed by it. And what does the Rav say? And this is how we're going to end the classes on the Rav. Because in the article, he stresses how the Rav's a born teacher. Not everyone is that way. Once after the Rav used to give Yortzeit Shir, 2 hours Halacha, 2 hours Agada, and you can listen to it. Even if you don't know Yiddish, you see the Rav, his language. Rav Gerelich said to the Rav after one of the shiurim that you're an actor, because the Rav said that he gets excited. And the Rav replied, indeed, that that's part of teaching. Everyone teaches has to be a bit of an actor. So, and the Rav always said that I'm a Muhammad. That's what he is, fundamental Muhammad. So he says, you are right, namely Lau, in his description of the Rav and his place in the shiur, you are right that I love teaching. The latter is, as far as I am concerned, a great experience, inspiring, redeeming, and cleansing of body and soul. We already saw another letter where the Rav says that although he's old and he's weak and he's tired, when he's in the shiur, he's invigorated, he's revitalized. He says, I enjoy sharing knowledge with others. I like the dialogue between teacher and student, and I find fulfillment in it. I am not lonely when I teach. One of the major themes in the Rav's writing is loneliness. Lonely man of faith, that every man is basically lonely. A real spiritual thinker, a real spiritual person, a religious thinker is going to be by definition lonely. But the Rav says, I'm not lonely when I teach. With the conclusion of the shiur or lecture, however, I return to my lonely abode in anticipation of another opportunity to teach. So the Rav is lonely. He's the individual confronting God by himself. But when he's in the shiur, he's there as a unit, as a group, and that takes away the loneliness. And with this, we complete 21 classes on the Rav's letters. I never thought I'd get to the Health God book because that wasn't an idea, but people thought it would be good, and I'm very happy you did. It was a learning experience for all of us, and the sentiments which I just read you from the Rav, that I enjoy sharing knowledge with others. That's the same with me as well. Love sharing it and love hearing from you. So now, before I get to the comments, let me just finish up just a few things I have, that things that have been on my either from last week or from previous weeks to share with you from previous classes. Well, the first is, and I thank Joel for sending this to me. If you haven't seen this, I recommend it. There is a publication that's come out a number of volumes now. It's called Sorba Mirabonim. What it is it's a it's put out by the Mizrahi. And since I mentioned Mizrahi, let me just note that the head of the Mizrahi, the revitalized Mizrahi movement, Rabbi Doron Perez, his son is among the people captured, kidnapped by Hamas. I mean, it's amazing how many people they're holding, and the way they cynically use them to delay the invasion or get points in the press, whatever it is. So that's very unfortunate. But he's been involved in a real revitalization of Mizrahi, and they come out with this volume. I don't know how often, but on different themes. In fact, my show just started 2 days ago between Mincha Ma'ariv, Chabura, on Hilchos Shabbos, using the Sorba Mirabonim. So they have on different issues there. And one of the issues deals with Hilchos Talmud Torah. So I don't have it in front of me. I just have the page it was sent to me. They deal with the study of Gemara for women. And I have to say, for the Mizrahi movement, I think they should have been more accurate in how they describe things. Because in speaking about women and studying Torah, they give the Chavetz Chaim's view. They give the Satmar Rebbe's view that... well, you know, the Satmar Rebbe, that's basically no learning, Eros Moshe, Rav Mohammed, but then they have Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Lichtenstein. Now, listen to how they summarize Rav Soloveitchik. I just have the summary, not all the pages. Women are permitted to study Gemara for the same reason as the Chafetz Chaim permitted other subjects. It is necessary to study high-level Torah material to maintain a Jewish commitment in the modern world. That is the Rav, the fact that today we're faced with the breakdown of tradition, and we need to educate women. They're educated in secular pursuits. We need to educate them in Torah. That is how the Rav's grandson, Rav Meir Tursky, explains the Rav's position. It's very traditional then. It's just the Chafetz Chaim, although today we just add Gemara because women today are more sophisticated, so we need to give them Gemara. This is not how Rabbi Wurzburger understood the Rav, and it's not how Rav Lichtenstein ever explained it. So I would say that there's a lacuna here. If they wanted to do this properly, they should have said there's a dispute among the Rav students how to understand him. But the next is, I would say, completely out of line, and that's Rav Lichtenstein. And they say, for Rav Lichtenstein, women may study Gemara based on the logic of the Chafetz Chaim, similar to the Rav. And that is absolutely incorrect. The Rav's position was not that there's a heter, that women are forbidden to study Gemara, but today, because of Eis Lassos, it's an emergency measure, we have to change things, therefore there's a, quote, heter for women to study Gemara. For Rav Lichtenstein, women were never forbidden to study Gemara. It wasn't done in those days because that wasn't the society they needed, but It's not that it's a, you know, from the Chafetz Chaim, that perspective, if we could somehow recreate the old society, then women would be forbidden to study Gemara. That's not the Rav's, that's not Rav Elstein's perspective. And Rav Elstein certainly thought he was following his father-in-law's perspective on this. You can just look at how the Rav Elstein writes about this, how his daughter, you know, they explain Migdalos, the Semin. This isn't, you know, they're not having advanced Talmud study where they learn the Ketzos HaChoshen and learn, you know, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, you know, Kovetz Biurim, because it's an emergency measure and there's a heter and we need, no, they think, Rav Lichtenstein thought there's a value in and of itself for women to learn. The fact that it's only in modern times that we do this, doesn't, that's because of outer society. It's not because it's a heter. And that's really, it's usher, but it's just es lasos, that sometimes we can go against halacha in the name of a larger good. That's not how Rav Lichtenstein saw it. And I trust him that he knew what his father-in-law's position was. And if you look in the my new post today, I make the exact same point about, I reviewed a book, a very nice book, by the way, by Benji Levy. But he wants to claim that the Rav's position, that Rav Aaron's position differs from the Rav when it comes to how to regard apostates like Brother Daniel. And we went over the Brother Daniel. We went into great detail on Brother Daniel. And it's not true. The Rav Lichtenstein's article, his famous article, Brother Daniel, is designed to explain the Rav's position. And as I say in my post, knowing how close they were, this must have been written under the guidance and in consultation with the Rav. The idea that Rav Aaron's position in that article is somehow at odds with the Rav is no. This is the Rav. The Rav Aaron wrote it to explain the Rav's position. So I have to say that I'm disappointed in the Torah Rabbanan that they did not get this right. About, at least about Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. About Duchening. So I told you about the Toronto show of Rabbi Felder, the Shomrei Shabbos show. And I mentioned also how this was a very, very popular practice in years past. I cited sources that say that. I'm a little surprised. If you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, it must have been in the Aruch HaShulchan's area. It was not a popular practice because the Aruch HaShulchan says that this used to be a popular practice. But he says in our day, Kvar Nispatel Bimenu. You know, the practice of not duchening on Shabbos has basically disappeared in our day. And he gives a reason because this minhag, he says, does not have a tam v'reach. It has no valid reason. And yet, despite what the Aruch HaShulchan says, we know that this was in the Aruch HaShulchan's day, that this was the popular practice in all sorts of places, including in Rodin. This was the practice. So I'm a little surprised at the language of the Aruch HaShulchan. By the way, one of you quoted Ramosha last week, Ramosha Feinstein, who's opposed to this practice of not duchening. He has another tshuva also as well, in which he says you have to get rid of it unless it's going to cause a dispute. If it's going to cause a dispute, if the community is very attached to this minhag of not duchening on Shabbos, then you don't need to, don't push it, because the Rosh says machokas is the worst thing. And now having machokas would be worse than not duchening. Even though from Moshe's position, he would agree, although he doesn't say this, but he definitely would agree with the common aphorism, you know, that there's sometimes a minhag is gehenim. Because the you know, the letters of minhag equal gehenim. So we have certain times where the minhag is really gehenim. That is, it's a problem. It's a bad minhag. But you have to worry about machokas. I think. Ian Tech emails me, the Jewish Center in Manhattan, on the Upper West Side, the famous Jewish Center, doesn't duchen on Yom Tov when it falls on Shabbos. And he says that he asked Rabbi Levine, who explained that that's the minhag. And they haven't changed it. If any of you live in the Upper West Side, you can tell me if anything's changed in the last couple of years. But as of a few years ago, Ian, and I know Ian, we had the pleasure of spending Pesach before COVID together. And thank you for that, Ian. A couple more things. I raised the question, did the Rav ever meet the Rabavitcher Rebbe? After the Rebbe became Rebbe. And thank you, Rav Nachum Shmaryahu, who points out that the Rav came to Menachem Avol, the Rebbe, in 64, when the Rebbe's mother passed away, and then they met at the famous Farbrengen. That would probably be the only examples. Now, Nachum Shmariahu mentioned something else, which I knew, but in my excitement last week, I didn't mention it. I was just saying what everyone says, how the Rav grew up in Chasovich, which is Chabad town. It goes on and on. And the Rav said that numerous times. Everyone says that. And yet, Munshein and others have pointed out, or argued at least, that Chasovich was not a Chabad town. It was a Misnagdic town. And yes, there was Chabadnikim there, but they were a minority. So why does the Rav portray it as Chabad? I don't have an explanation. And assuming that they are right, that the Chabad were a minority in this town, I don't have an explanation as to why the Rav explains it. Now, as for the story, the famous story, that Chaslovich, even though it's Chabad, it picked a Misnagid Rav because the Alter Rebbe was running away from Napoleon, and he was hidden by the rabbi, as Nachum Shmariahu says, that the Rav must have just been repeating an urban legend, because we know for a fact that the Alter Rebbe was nowhere near Chaslovich. So, what can I say? Two more things. I had listened to one of the talks, you know, we dealt with the Rav, and I published it in the post. That's why I thought of it again on today, about reheating on Shabbos. I think I said that according to the Rav, if something's on the stove, you take it off the stove, being a shmasho, so you then put it on Shabbos, you can put it on Shabbos, Shabbos morning. However, that's not exact. The Rav held it needs to be on the stove the entire Bein HaShmashos. That is, until it's dark, until it's Tzeis HaChavim. So if anyone wanted to adopt this position, I think you need to get it right. And finally, the last thing I want to say, you know, 2 weeks ago we spoke about how difficult, or I spoke about how difficult it is to teach that night, with the weight of what is happening in Israel. In fact, my son that day had emailed me. He had just found out that a friend of his from Oshava had been killed the very first day, Saturday. Someone that he was, a guy who was only married a year. He was, I saw the funeral on YouTube a couple of days ago. So we were all suffering that, but we said, you know, we're not going to let, first of all, Hamas can't win. We have to learn Torah. We have to, and also it takes our mind a bit away from the difficulties, you know, the rest of the time that we're feeling. Torah is the elixir of life. I said, how could we really have danced on the simplest Torah? It's so difficult. Well, I received in the mail a couple of days ago this volume of Hamayan. And just so you don't think I make it up, look how they spell. I've made this point a lot. It's not Hamayan, it's Hamayan. Because as we've said, under the ayin there's a shva. And this is an extra large issue. You can see it online, and it's focused on the Yom Kippur War, 50 years. And you have some great stuff in here. You have the memoir of Rabbi Zev Weitman. He's the Rav of Tanuva, from, I think he's in Alon Shvut, discussing his experience. He was saved with Nisim, and many others. And what caught my eye, I'm going to share it with you. And some of you might not like what I'm going to say now. You might reject it. I mean, it's not what I'm saying. When I'm quoting you, you might think it's it shows a lack of emotion, a lack of reality, but I'm not making the story. I'm just telling it to you. And this is history. I'm not covering it up. It's reality. There's an article here of Huttner and the Yom Kippur War. Now, we asked how we could dance on Simchas Torah, or should we dance, all that. The same issue came in the Yom Kippur War. You know, can you rejoice on Yom Tov? And Sukkot was right afterwards, and Israel was in the midst of a terrible, terrible war. So I just wanted to share with you what was said, that Rav Huttner, who was in America at the time, and he says as follows. He said as follows. It was Sukkot. Look, even in Brooklyn, it was a problem. Everyone knew what was going on in Israel, and it was terrible. Refutner, he points out in this article, dealt with the situation a number of times, but he was, he says that I have to now answer a question that he was asked, why we didn't say Tehillim in the show on Sukkos. Now, we said Avinu Malkeinu last Shabbos because of Rav Schechter. Although someone said that Rav Schechter says you're not supposed to say Chatanu. I don't know if that's true or not. But we said the whole Avinu Malkeinu. But they didn't say Tehillim there on Shabbos. We said Tehillim. And Rabbi Huttner said, it's not that we're afraid of saying Tehillim. But he says that when we first received the news of what was happening in Yom Kippur, we said Tehillim in the middle of Musaf. He says, today we didn't say it. And he says, that when you gather a community in the basin, in a shul, and you're going to say Tehillim, there are those that it's impossible for them to say Tehillim without losing their Simchas Yom Tov. And, or their Simchas Shabbos. And he says, that we can't have. And he says, to say Tehillim, to say we're going to say Tehillim, and we'll assume that it's not going to affect our Simchas Shabbos, Simchas Yom Tov, he says that that we can't do, that most people, they can't do that, because it does create sadness. And I can tell you 100% that when we said Tehillim, Mimamakim, and the others that we said on Shabbos, it definitely took away some of our Simcha. So maybe we should take away some of our Simcha. Maybe it's appropriate. But Rav Huttner thought it wasn't appropriate. And we have other examples of great rabbis who heard about a death on Shabbos. And, you know, these are superhuman people. Even the Rav, as I recall, he heard about his brother's death, maybe it was on Shabbos, and he didn't affect him. So this is Rav Huttner. And Rav Huttner's attitude was that on Shabbos and Yom Tov, we don't do anything to take away from the Simcha, and that means on Simchas Torah you would dance. And if you'd ask Rav Huttner, I have no doubt he would say, apart from this reason, we're not going to give Hamas, or the Arabs, the victory. It's enough they killed our people, we're going to let them destroy our Yom Tov, we're not going to give them that. My question is, how can you not? I mean, we're not superhuman. That's what Rabbi Huttner says. I know it might upset some of you, but I wanted to share that. But it's not, and it goes further. Because in the article, they also quote the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe was also asked in the same year about this. And, no, I'm sorry, I wasn't asked. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, who said, Dafka, we have to lahosif b'simcha, and we have to add more simcha. When they try to destroy us, we have to add more simcha. And then he quotes a story from the Lubavitcher Rebbe about this, which to explain how, you could say, on the Yom Kippur War of simcha and all this. And this relates to something we heard from the Rav also a few classes ago. We know that in Pesach we say Shvoch HaMasva. Pour out their wrath on the nations, know thee not. And we know that on certain days, we have the month of Av, we have days of sadness. However, just like we have days of sadness, and just like on Pesach there's a time when we say Shvoch HaMasva, at other times he says, we have no permission. We are not allowed to insert into days of joy, namely holidays, matters which are the opposite of simcha, only where the sages and the Torah told us we can. And therefore, he says that when you're sitting at the Passover Seder and people want to add something into the Seder, for example, we saw the Rav, they wanted to add about Soviet Jewry, or others, people, there were others who wanted to add something about the Holocaust in the Seder. The Rav, sorry, actually, that's what you see, Yehuda, anything like this, the Rebbe said, no, we don't put, something sad into Simcha. And then it continues in the note here, and it quotes with Tzvi Yehuda Cook, that They were worried. They wanted to know in the year of Yom Kippur War, usually Merkaz HaRav, they go dancing on the streets. They would dance all the way to the chief rabbi's house. Should they do that in Simchas Torah? And Ritzi Yehuda said, absolutely, we continue doing this. And he says that we have to do Simchas HaChag Ragil. I forget now. It was... maybe it's not here, but there's someone somewhere else I saw it, where someone wanted to add in, you know, something about the Holocaust and the Seder. You know, in every generation they try to destroy us, and the answer given was no. And finally, the last thing that is mentioned here about this is that Rav Huttner says that he spoke with Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and Rav Yaakov also agreed that she'ein chalila lema'et b'shum ofen misimchas achag. That we can't lessen the simcha at all. And the idea is that b'schus simchas yom tov tova hatzala. And, okay, and he goes on, with this. After he says, actually, then he continues something else. When they were with the Balabatim, he says they wouldn't say Tehillim. But later, at the Masiba of the Chag of Bnei Torah, you know, Bnei Torah, Futner says, there's Yesh Barosha Makom Aniach Shnei Tefillin. It's a play on this idea that, you know, Tefillin, they used to, you know, the Gemara said you have to have two room for two Tefillin. In fact, that's how I used to wear Rashi and Rebbeinu Tam. No Martillin. So Rav Huttner says that with, you know, Bnei Torah, yeshiva students, they're sophisticated Torah Jews enough to know, he thinks, that they will understand that there's no stira to say Tehillim and also have Simcha Nechag. But when it comes to the masses, he says, the Balabatim, they won't understand that. And what can I say? I'm not one of the Bnei Torah. I'm just a Balabas, because I have to say that it did take away from my Simcha Shabbos. There's no question. Not that long, but at least, you know, that time, the 15 minutes or so. But I don't feel bad about that. And that makes me, if I wasn't part of the mitzvah Simchas Yom Tov, what can I say? But it's, you know, this is something that's consuming me day and night, and I'm not going to apologize for it. And I think a lot of people would agree with me, but that doesn't make it right.
If I can interrupt for one second.
So Mark, I'm with this, Rabbi Kelman, yeah.
No, I was just going to say, Rabbi Felder, I when I came to shul on Simchas Torah, I heard you were talking about Rabbi Felder and Shomer Shabbos. So him and Rabbi Miller, who's the head of the Lakewood Kol in Toronto, they canceled Hakafot, which I found very, that's the message we had heard, that they had canceled Hakafot. And, you know, I think it's, there's a lot more than pure halacha that goes into this. It's
Rabbi Yehuda said absolutely not. He said to continue. Rav Tzvi Yehuda's attitude was that, right, you know, we
I think
don't
there is a difference for people who live in Israel and people who live in Chutz Laaretz. I think people
think
live
so, maybe.
It's much more important they try to, you know, I don't know. That's what I think. I don't know if they have people, whatever. It's complicated. But anyways, you can go through the questions in the, some of the
comments. I will get to that. Probably I can tell you, because I have someone who listens, who's from, he has many contacts in the really right-wing extreme Hasidic world, and he is shocked because life goes on in normal there. And he said they couldn't understand why he was so upset. And so I don't know. And
that's true. I was
that's obviously the if we say Avinu Malkeinu, Rav Schachter says to say Avinu Malkeinu. You can't say Avinu Malkeinu and not be affected. So he obviously doesn't hold like we just saw. So let me get to the questions and comments before we end this session. Someone privately, Mel, I see your text. It's a big tragedy, unfortunately. David says, as a student of Rav Aharon Lichtenstein, I can attest I always prefer listening to Shirim in Hebrew or English, which was a level far higher than my English, and he also spoke slightly lower when speaking in Hebrew. But yes, David, all I would say, though, is Rav Lichtenstein, his native language is not Hebrew. So it makes sense that his English would be higher than Hebrew. Rabbi Soloveitchik learned English. How old was he? He's born in 1903, so he learned English after his 30s, and he becomes a master of the English language. And it's not his first language. It's not even his second language. His first language is Yiddish. His second language is Russian. I assume he knew Polish or Russian. His second language is German, sorry. I assume he knew Polish and Russian to a certain extent. So that's what makes it so incredible. That, and we saw, I read you some of the things. His ability with the language, the English language, the Rav, granted, it's an ability that he got from reading. No one speaks like that. But still, it's one of the most impressive things about the Rav, the way he was able to write. And writing's the hardest thing. Learning to speak a foreign language is much, much easier than actually, and obviously easiest to understand it than to speak it, and but to write in it is so difficult. And you're dealing with geniuses here. That's all I can say, geniuses. David also says another significant halacha is that those who are killed because of Hashem do not undergo a tara, as the manner in which they are murdered does not necessitate conducting a tara. Thank you, thank you. Mel says that a member of the IDF Chevra Kadisha was on the David Beshefson podcast, and he explained that they do not do a tara for the victims of Hamas. I assume, therefore, also they bury them in their clothes that they were killed in, because that's the halacha. As far as I know, that's the uncontested halacha. That's what the Rav quotes to say that about the to prove that the flag has a kedusha. So if you, I don't know. By the way, I'm going to be on that podcast soon. I was supposed to be on it
Correct.
already, but
That's right.
because of what's going on, it's being pushed off, the Beshefkin. Mark says, would I say the same thing about Ladino? I mean, would the Rav say the same thing about Ladino? Well, it's not just Ladino. It's Judeo Arabic. Ladino was the language of Jews in the Ottoman Empire, Turkey, Greece. The Jews in the Arab world spoke Judeo Arabic. I guess he would say the same thing about it. Ladino's undergoing a bit of a comeback as well. I guess so. You're right. Why should we be ethnocentric here, focusing on the Yiddish, not about the other Jewish languages? Nissen says the flag is patterned after the Talis. Black stripe on ours may originally been blue, like it's peeled chaos. Yeah, this is something I find very interesting, Nissen, because they say the flag is patterned after the Talis. And even if you look in the Mishnah, I believe it's the Mishnah Berurah, not the Aruch HaShulchan, he mentions blue in a Talis. And yet in traditional communities, you never see blue. I've never seen a blue Talis. It's only the religious Zionists who have blue and white. You go to yeshivas. So if blue was ever used as a Talis in Eastern Europe, which we have testimony it was, when did blue ever disappear from our Talisim? And how come it's not frum to wear blue? I don't understand. If anyone can find the answer to that, I'd like to know. I think it's the Mishnah Berurah who mentions blue as well. Zoom just says Temple Mount may be intrinsically holy, even though there's no Jewish present there. Debating Gemara. Look, the Rav's whole idea, and with Meir Simcha's whole idea about there not being any inherent holiness, can be contradicted by many sources. And the Rav I quote, he says about Nida also. There's many sources that contradict it, but they have this idea, and either they can interpret all these other sources, or they say that these sources are not in line with the mainstream. Kellner, in his book, thinks that this is the Rambam's position as well. Yocheved says that Refer Shachter quotes the Rav of Kedusha Eretz Yisrael. He said in a drasha that when Yeshua's army conquered the land, they brought the Aron with the Luchos along, and this action is what made land holy, not a mystical inherent holiness. Yeah, but I could show you many sources that say otherwise. I guess the Rav would say, look, we have the Rav on tape where someone challenged him at one of the Arche Kalos and says, but the Maharal says this. And he says, the Maharal is not in our tradition. He means my tradition, I guess. So if that's going to be your answer, then of course. And the Rav discounts many views that he thinks are not in line with what he thinks is the in his approach to understand Judaism. That is the approach he follows. He doesn't deny that these exist, but he says that this is not my approach. So when he argues a certain way about Tumah Tara, he thinks this is the most authentic. Or Kedusha, this is the most authentic way to read it. We have
and Mark,
here.
And other, and just Mark?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to mention that the Rav being the Rav,
he contradicts himself, and in a shir on Lech Lecha, he quotes the Ramban, and he makes a big deal about the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael, the inherent Kedusha is what pulled Abraham. He sensed it somehow. So,
I know, the Rav has a lot of contradictions. The Rav has a lot of contradictions. It's a question that people have raised. There's a lot of contradictions. But in the Shiurim, sometimes I raise this in my blog post also. Sometimes in the Shiurim, the Rav isn't so careful. He throws out ideas. When he writes things, that's like Godot wrote. And he's not just throwing out provisional ideas. So I don't know. I mean, the Rav also challenges the Ramban's view and about Eretz Yisrael. And in the Rav Thinking Loud, he says, we can't accept the Ramban on this. We just can't accept it. So that's an issue, the contradictions in the Rav. So we have Ricky that in Montreal, there's a lot of Bells families and they all speak Yiddish. A pleasure to hear. Okay, yes, it's Bells, it's Bobov, it's Satmar. I can tell you that my family in Israel, the Hasidim, they're Ger Hasidim. It's an interesting divergence here because the boys, their first language is Yiddish. In the house, the parents speak Hebrew. So the people grow up and the boys go to yeshiva and everything's in Yiddish. So I shouldn't say it's their first language, but they know Yiddish. They're fluent in Yiddish, although they don't speak it among each other. The girls, however, go to Beis Yaakov where they don't learn Yiddish. So the girls don't even know Yiddish. It's not like the Satmar and I guess the Bells and others where the family, they grow up speaking Yiddish. In my cousins, the Gerach, in the family, they speak Hebrew and the girls don't even know Yiddish. So that's of interest. Mark says we need to differentiate between those keeping Yiddish alive because it's worth keeping alive and those who use Yiddish as a vehicle for avoiding corrupting English. Okay. And Rabbi Kelman says, even Hebrew is barely taught today. Almost no Ivrit anywhere in America. It's a problem. You go to France. You can speak to anyone in Hebrew. All the Jews there, all the Jewish schools, they give them a great Hebrew education, I'm told. And that's in America the same thing. You go to Gerba. Forget it. No one there speaks English. But everyone, including boys, girls, everyone, they all speak Hebrew. We don't have it. I don't know why we can't do it. If you send your children to the French school in America, they'll learn to speak fluent French. I'm not sure. Is it that we don't have the teachers? I know in my high school we couldn't do it because the rabbis couldn't speak it. They're from the yeshiva world. And how many rabbis can you find that do Ivrit? I don't know. But Mark says that Frisch taught Latin for a while. Okay, that's nice. Aviata Cohen is at Sharia Mishpat. He's a Gush graduate. Martin says there's a 2000 book called The Jewish Divide Over Israel, a series of essays on a Jewish writer who were hostile for Israel. I wrote an essay for the book on Thomas Friedman. It's available from Amazon. Thank you, Martin. Yes, you sent me that years ago. I just have to say that Thomas Friedman he's a leftist, maybe progressive, but he fundamentally believes in the existence of the state of Israel. A two-state solution, but he's a Zionist. He believes in Israel. The problem today is that we have Jews, many, many Jews, who are anti-Israel, who don't believe in a two-state solution. They're like PA and Hamas. They believe in the one-state solution. If you look today, University of Michigan, there's a letter signed by like eight Jews. My son sent it to me. They claim to be Jewish, anti-Zionist. They oppose the existence of the state of Israel. So today, when we talk about being hostile to Israel, it was bad enough years ago, but now we're talking about people who don't believe in the existence. Peter Beinart and his group and people even worse than that. We've had Jews marching with Hamas in the rallies. How do I know that? Because I've been reading nonstop all these articles that talk about, now Jews are waking up to the problem on the left. And some of them have been quoting Jews who haven't woken up and they're out there marching. So if Thomas Friedman was as bad as it gets, I'd say a Shechianu.
I would.
Your apartment says when he was at MTA, he and a friend wanted to take Latin. But MTA refused it with two students. And David says that in Hebrew, they pronounce it, well, I guess it wouldn't be Ubi-Stein or Weihlichtenstein. But how did he pronounce it as a family? I once had a whole thing with someone in Ramosha's family about that as well. And Mel says Rav Aaron's father was his French teacher, and you called him Lichtenstein. Yes. And it was Miriam's son, Daniel. David says, spending Shabbat with his uncle. And Samuel says, in my Maimonides school, we all took Latin. Do they still take it, have it there? Okay, quickly, I'll end it off. And Mark says, regarding evil, the notion of not why did it happen, but how do I respond to it? This is really the Rav's thrust and cold duty to faith. As I said, he repeats this again and again. The Rav has certain themes that he repeats again and again. And David says that Rav Lichtenstein would take umbrage of those rabbis who pronounce, following a tragedy, the reasons for such a tragedy. And he'll quote the Gemara in Brachos regarding Bilam, who boasted that he knew Das Elyon. To which the Gemara says, he doesn't know the donkey, he knows Das Elyon. Yocheved says that her father went to see Chaim Grada and asked him why he never responded to the Chazon Ish's letter. And he said, quote, I don't know if I see him, I will be obligated to do tshuva. I'm not ready to do that. Chaim Grada couldn't go to Israel. He couldn't face the Chazon Ish. I've heard that also. But the question is, why did he become irreligious? Was he just, was it his taivas? That's what they say in the Haredi world. You know, he wanted to be all the women, but they always say that about people. was it, you know, many people, the best and the brightest, fell in with secular groups, either Zionist or Yiddishist or Bundist. And Ira says that all of the Ira, who your son is living in my town now, all of the 8 Yehuda children, the Tzvi Yehuda's family, are now called up to serve, one half on the front lines. Rabbis and Wives was published. Okay, everyone. Thank you. Yes, and one more thing that Mel says, Rabbi Peretz's other son, I saw this on Srugim.com or whatever, the Srugim website, his other son just got married. So here they have one son, hostage in Israel. Who knows what's going to be with him? And the other son got married. And I don't know if I could do it, but they, you know, they were mesameach, because you have to do that. There's a time to mourn. What does it say in Erica Brown's favorite book? There's a time to mourn and a time to rejoice, and we're going to let Hamas destroy everything to us. Our greatest revenge is to build another Bayis Ne'eman. Every time you meet someone who survived the Holocaust and you see the wedding picture with them, with the grandchildren, great-grandchildren, they always say that that's our revenge. To build another Bayis Ne'eman B'Yisrael, to have another wedding, that's the biggest response to Hamas. So yes, I saw that as well. Thank you for reminding it to me. And okay, there's a lot more more comments. I think it is already. We've gone long enough. If something you wrote to me you think is worth me commenting on, because the people on with us, they saw it. For the rest of them, please send it to me, copy it and send it to me. I'm happy to get to it. But it's already 9:43. So again, I want to thank you all very much. This is a really exciting series of semesters. I learned a lot from all the comments. And I hope you learned something as well. For all those who are not live with us, please, you can join us live. We have many more listening who are not live. But for all those who are live, I couldn't do it without you. I can't just get up and speak. It's not a podcast. I need the give and take. And for the ones I'm just looking at, this on your back, Mark, today you have it. So many of you, Mel, of course, Marty, and the rest of you. I don't leave anyone out. Thank you so much for the comments. And with that, we say we're done. Rabbi Kelman.
We're done, Beth. We're back next week at the same time. Please God, the Würzburger Rav, we're back, as I said at the beginning, back to our series there. By the way, we have over 200 talks. As we mentioned, you know, many times, we were doing this before COVID, before anybody heard of Zoom. So we've got talks on many Gedolei Yisrael from the entire spectrum. Trust me, the entire spectrum. And you can listen to those. They're all on they're not on YouTube. We didn't do it originally on YouTube, but you can listen on the audio. So we'll go back to that series beginning next next week, please God. Should be a good week for everybody, for the Jewish people, please God. And tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman continues his class on Qehelet. Wednesday, I don't know if we've had this, but we're having four classes, just the way people's schedule worked out. Two new series. Okay, Simi Peters and Julie Mishkin are being doing Wednesdays. And Shlomo Brody, head of Amatai, will start a four-part series on end-of-life critical issues. We're going to be discussing this week, can you daven for a terminally ill patient to die? That'll be this week, 2:15, right after Shuli's class, which is at 1. And then at 8:30 at night, Wednesday night, Nati Helfgott, Rabbi Nati Helfgott from Tinek, who will be continuing. Last year, he gave basically a year-long series on Malachim Aleph. They're going to start Wednesday night a series on Malachim Beit, pretty much for the rest of the year. So that will be Wednesday night. So we've got 10 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2:15, and 8:30 Eastern on Wednesday. And then Thursday, Ruth Shane, who's not here tonight, but often comes to me in every classes, will be giving the Parsha Shear. And then my Shear, please God, on the Siddur on Friday. Next week, very important to note that they changed the clock in Israel. Daylight Savings Time, they're going back to Eastern Standard Time. I don't know what it's called in Israel. I don't think it's called Eastern Standard Time, but regular time. And so the classes will follow the Eastern schedule. In other words, there'll be six Davids. So next week, you got to get up at 2:30 or 2:30. Maybe you don't go to bed. But by the way, that's just for the 1 week. They changed the week earlier. So just to make note for next week classes, those, I don't think there are too many people over here in Israel. Anyways, besides David, and but I didn't get a chance to write, I just say a comment on Rav Taborius, Rav Binyamin Tamar. I'm sure you know, he's my Rosh Hashiva. The 4 years he was in Toronto were the 4 years I was in high school, and he really was a tremendous teacher. Those who know Rav Binyamin Tabor, Yalav HaShalom, says really, and then was Rebbe in Gush for many years. Really, he did have a tremendous ability to teach Balabatim and regular people. So your comment is very yes, and of course, friendly with his son, who I remember as a little kid, Rav Aviyat. But anyways, it's a small world. Okay, we should, we look forward to learning with you. And like I said, please go, we should hear B'surot Tovot. That's, nobody knows. Ein lanu le'olim mishein elu avinu shebashamayim. And let's hope he hears the Avinu Malkeinu's and all the Shir Malot and all our learning and all our mitzvot bein adam l'chaveiro to bring the Jewish people all together. Okay, Laila Tov, everybody. And,
Hope Shalom Aleinu v'al kol Yisrael.
Amen. Amen. Okay. I'm just looking at some of the comments that I didn't even see yet. Okay. There's an ethical man. Okay.
Okay. Hey, I personally, this is firsthand knowledge because I was at Modern Orthodox, Yeshivish, and Hasidic shuls in Bar Park and Flatbush over the Yom Kippur.
Right.
And almost, they all, Babov said Tehillim on Simchas Torah. Everybody said Tehillim. I had one, I don't want to say who I saw him on Monday on Yisru Chag, and I had one question. I said, did you say, because I know that he is a very big Simchas Torah, you know, he's a Simcha fellow, you know, and he gets, yes. he runs a shul and he can't even, he staggers on Purim because that's how drunk he is. And he's a sincere person. And I had one question. I said, did you say till him yesterday? And he waved to me, no. So I said, Chabdir in boots, you know, which means whatever. That's Yiddish.
No, I kind of listened.
Everybody said, tell me.
Arshul did hakapos regularly. The truth of the matter, I felt, I don't know, I didn't feel comfortable with hakapos. And I was having, it just somehow, you know, in Israel, they're mourning and everything. And how can we dance with the Sefer Torah? I get it in Israel. Although in Israel, lots of people went home. Some people, I don't know, people found out during shul or whatever, but I don't know. And then I did, like I mentioned before, Rabbi Felder Shul, I heard they did cancel Hakafot. And then I heard that Shir Shemaim, which is like the modern Orthodox shul in the same area, you know, also canceled. I don't know exactly what everybody did, but I know our rabbi on Shemini Atzeret morning, he obviously changed his whole speech because he spoke very nice and he spoke. His theme was, you know, we're not going to let them win. I mean, we didn't know the details, of course, at 10:30 in the morning on Shabbos morning, but, you know, we're going to dance as we have to dance, whatever. That was the idea. But of course they said to Hillim and they, whatever. And in the end, we'd say Avinu Malkeinu every day, et cetera. But, All right. Listen.
In one of the shtables I down on Shabbos, without someone said, "Oh, Nissan, you should lead us in the Mishbech for Saha," which they otherwise wouldn't make. And the Gabbai said, "I have it already. I have it."
Yeah. So I saw Menachem Bombach wrote an article in Times of Israel. I don't know if people know who he is. I don't even know his exact title, but he's a Vishnitz Chassid, right. I believe. I'm sorry.
He has pioneered
Yeah, I think he grew up in Meir Sharm or Geula. He has a PhD. He's still Hasidic, like he's still the whole thing, but he joined the army. He has all these schools where they do Bagrut. And, you know, he wrote that, I think it was Bells, that Tfilah L'Shlom for Tzahal. And, you know, for people in our community, big deal. Like, well, that's the least you can do. But he said, no, it is a big deal. He didn't say that is a big deal. And, you know, small steps. I think. Yeah, because whatever, that is something to whatever. I understand, and David, you can probably concur. I just know what I read in the papers that Haredim have lined up to join the army. I mean, it's not like all of them.
Thousands and thousands are lining up.
Yeah, so that's pretty amazing, and that is really quite amazing. And listen, like I say, it's a terrible thing, but let's hope at least something good can come out of it, especially the unity of the Jewish people, that people begin to understand each other, because we were so split, especially for the last 9 months. It's been terrible, and whatever. It's sad that it takes to bring it together. But anyways, yeah, so you know more there, Bab, but that's what they say. Their papers are reporting the Haredim joining the army and whatever. All right. Laila Tov, everybody. We should be well. David, are you going to sleep? I hope. I know it's hard to sleep, I guess.
No, I'm going to the 6 a.m. minion, and then I'm playing tennis.
Okay. All right. All right. Be well, everybody. Okay. Laila Tov. Go to. Bye-bye.